Smestions.
Well, thank you very much indeed for downloading another podcast from your friends.
Another
here
podcast
at The Take. Question from Orla. In your view, who is a successful singer but not a very good singer?
Ooh.
Now, I have this...
Bob Dylan.
Yeah, I mean, he's the perfect place to start, isn't he? Because
yes.
Can... Has he...
But brilliant.
Yes. So here, this is where the kind of... He's not a great singer, but he's a fantastic vocalist. Is that...
Yes,
that's
okay,
the good
that's
way
it,
out.
Yes, not a great singer, but a fantastic vocalist.
Because Mark Knopfler, I would put in the same category. But I love Mark Knopfler's stuff. I really, really... He's not just a great guitarist, but I love it when he's singing. But classically, he's not great. Leonard Cohen. You wouldn't say he's got an incredible range or, you know, but he's just a fantastic vocalist who you could listen to.
Yeah.
Well, now, the redactor has just said Johnny Cash.
No, Johnny Cash
has got a better voice than any of those.
Can I go for Patti Smith?
If you wish to.
Because I think Patti Smith is a brilliant vocalist, but I don't know that I'd say she was a great singer because what she's doing is somewhere between spoken poetry and, you know, it's that, isn't it? It's to do with... And although I hate to say this because he's such an annoying person, but John Lydon, which is correct.
John Lydon.
John Lydon.
Johnny Rotten,
was a good example of somebody who was a good vocalist but a rubbish singer.
Yes, I guess that would work.
And I'm not a fan, but you can't deny that those records sound like they sound because of his delivery.
Yes, and the delivery is extraordinary. Adam's question. As a sufferer of general anxiety, I often find my mind wandering elsewhere, which can happen any time, such as in a conversation or whilst trying to finish a simple task. I find I have to remind my brain to concentrate in order to focus on what's in front of me. Unfortunately, this can happen while partaking in one of my favourite pastimes, which is watching movies. There have been cases where my wife has said, "You haven't been listening for the last 5 minutes," to which my brain goes, "Oh, wow, you're right, I haven't. Wake up and concentrate." As a fellow sufferer of general anxiety, I'm wondering if this is something that Mark has ever experienced. I recall him saying that a sign of a really great movie, particularly horror, is when you realize that you haven't thought of anything else for the entire duration of the film. However, I'd like to know if Mark has any tips that he could share to enhance my viewing experiences and concentrate better. So this is a very specific issue where anxiety causes your mind to wander, even in a film?
Yep. I mean, it's like... I could have written that email. I know exactly what you mean. And honestly, it's the only solution is that the film is good. And I really mean it when I say that you know that a film has worked well because you've spent the duration of the film thinking about the film and not thinking about all those other things. And one of the hardest parts of my job, which is watching films, I do understand how terrible that sounds, is if you see 6 films in a week, the chances are that some of them won't be very good. Or they'll be average, and your mind starts to wander. And my mind always wanders anxiously. It does not. It never wanders lonely as a cloud or free or, you know, in a fluffy way. And I have many, many times sat in a screening room, staring at the screen, thinking, "Please take my mind off this thing that I'm worrying about." I kind of, you know, I've even had that feeling sometimes of if somebody has told me that a film is really good. And this is on the subject of length. You know, Anatomy of a Fall is like, it's way of 2 hours. And I thought, but everyone says it's brilliant. During the course of that film, I hope I don't worry about the things that I'm worrying about. And I didn't. So no, I absolutely understand. And I don't have a solution other than brilliant films will stop you doing it.
Adam concludes, "I'm still finding Mark's robbery." I think there's some ionized lines coming up. "I'm still finding Mark's robbery of a point for his John Wick answer painful. However, his maturity to brush it aside and move on shows that his CBT has worked wonderfully." Someone is listening very carefully.
Very carefully.
Ed Harrison. "Dear Salieri and Mozart, whilst catching up on the 27th of October episode, I was distressed by Simon's admission that he'd missed the showing of Amadeus with a live orchestra. It probably won't help his mood when I say it was
brilliant
at the Royal Albert Hall. Oh, well, the good lady ceramicist was, you know, she
could
make it."
Yeah, she came back in having enjoyed it enormously, didn't she?
"If it's a Tuesday night, it ain't going to happen for me because I'm working on this show. So that's the thing.
You're serving me chocolates."
And precisely right. Anyway, it was at the Royal Albert Hall. It was great. Hopefully, it will be of some comfort to him, though the entire reason that I went was because of Simon's fanaticism about Amadeus. And when I saw it crop up on the Royal Albert Hall emails, I thought, ooh, that's Simon's favourite film. I really must go along. It has prompted me to write in asking for a code of conduct clarification. That's why it's in this bit of the podcast. on end credits. Mm-hmm. I confess I have been known to leave, in quotes, normal cinema screenings before the credits have completed rolling. But at this particular performance, I was appalled at the behaviour of, admittedly, a minority of patrons around me. Watching a film with a live orchestra is not the most cost-effective way of seeing a movie. You're clearly paying a very high premium for the focus to be on the music and the orchestra. Obviously, when the film is running, you're concentrating on the film, the dialogue through subtitles and the soaring music. Once you hit the credits, though, it's surely the orchestra's chance to shine. Consequently, I was livid when the couple next to me started chatting immediately the credits rolled, which, of course, bear in mind, is the romanza from the 20th Piano Concerto and is an exquisite piece of music. Over to you, the pianist, and then people are chatting. That's not good enough. Consequently, I was livid. Betraying my English nature, after about 2 minutes, I actually told them to cork it. Yes.
Wow.
That's how riled I was. I thought I was in the Beano. Even as they looked sheepish and settled into silence, though, others around them were getting up and leaving. What's the general code on end credits? And if one is allowed to leave under normal circumstances, can we at least make a codicil that you don't leave if there's a live orchestra playing?
Yeah, I think talking or leaving while a live orchestra is playing is weird. Not least because you've paid a large amount of money, as you quite rightly say, to hear the live orchestra playing.
And it's particularly in that film, I mean, I'm saying it not really as a joke, it's an exquisite piece of music to finish. Why would you go anywhere?
There's another thing as well, which is because I do a film soundtrack show on Scala every Saturday, 1 o'clock.
It's a rocking show.
Most varied film soundtrack show anywhere on the radio. And quite often, I was talking to Rachel Portman about this, composers like the end credits because
Oscar-winning Rachel Portman, I think.
Oscar-winning Rachel Portman, yes. Because they get to write a longer piece of music incorporating the main themes of the film. Now, obviously, in the case of Amadeus, the music has been previously written by, what's he called?
Wolfgang
Salieri. Yes. So, Wolfie. But quite often, the end credits music, I mean, nowadays, you'll get something plastered over the end, or you'll get a selection of pops or whatever. But quite often the end credits music is absolutely brilliant. It is true that in cinemas, they have a habit now of putting the lights at least halfway up during the end credits. And it's also true that in the case of, I mean, Marvel basically did this thing about you sit through the end credits because you have to, because at the very, 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 very end, Howard the Duck is going to turn up, or, you know, whatever it is. But I think if you're with a live orchestra, you just listen to the orchestra. I mean, they're playing. I mean, they're actually playing. If you start talking, that's rude. They're playing the music.
Yes. So obviously some people have to go because they've got trains to catch.
Yeah.
But you don't talk through the
And if you romanza. Have to leave, do it as quietly and unobtrusively as possible.
Harriet Ingalls. Simon and Mark, medium-term listener since the peak Commodian rant over Blackbird and first-time emailer. I listened completely rapt to your interview with Thelma Schoonmaker.
Yeah.
An amazing and fantastically interested and open woman.
Utterly amazeballs interview.
My query is around how such institutions as the Academy Awards examine film shortlisted for best editing. How do you judge best editing? Do they watch the unedited version and then the final cut?
There's no such thing as the unedited version.
Yours inquisitively, Harriet Ingalls.
As far as I understand, and believe me, the amount that I understand about awards is not that much, it's chapter voting. So I believe that editors vote for the awards for editing, and cinematographers vote for the awards, at least for the nominations, as far as I understand.
So only the people who actually know what they're talking about.
I think that's the case. Certainly there's chapter voting in BAFTAs, and I believe that is the case for those categories, is that at least the initial selection is done by people who know what they're talking about. I stand to be corrected because the Academy changed its practices quite a lot. And I'm a member of the BAFTAs and I've never fully understood how the chapter voting works. So if anyone knows better, please let me know. But I am pretty convinced that the way it works is that your editors at least initially choose the field of editors because, you know, there's no such thing as the unedited movie. There's just rushes. And and nothing assembles itself. There's,
No, I mean, this obviously didn't come up because people heard the interview with Thelma Schoonmaker. But in the stuff that I was reading about it, she had said in another interview that they only took 20 minutes
out of the original assembly. Yes,
there was obviously an original thing, and she was amazed at how little they took out.
Yeah. Okay. Basically. So just to be clear about the way this works, so an assembly of the film is basically putting the stuff that you shot in sequence together. Okay, that is the assembly, and then. When you edit the film, you shape and shift and change. The crucial thing is an editor's job is not to make a film longer or shorter, refer to previous listener email. An editor's job is to serve the director in the way in which a scene and a movie during the course of it plays out. It's not to do with length. Obviously, when you shoot a movie, the original assembly of the whole film will be the longest possible version. Although, unless you could go back and put flashback, I suppose, in. But it's like, and then from that, you edit the film. But the key thing is not to do with making it shorter. What Thelma Schoonmaker is saying in that in a film of that kind of length, if the original assembly is only 20 minutes longer, that means you pretty much shot what was needed. The core example here would be Michael Cimino's Heaven's Gate, a film that I am not a fan of. I'm not a fan of Michael Cimino at all. I think he was a massively overrated and incredibly badly behaved director. His original contract for Heaven's Gate said that he had to deliver a version that was, I think it was like it had to be under 2.5 hours. And at the end of Richard Bach's, the chapter of Richard Bach's brilliant book, Final Cut, which is about how Heaven's Gate destroyed United Artists because Michael Cimino just let things get away with him. He said that he was editing. He was trying to get it down to 2.5 hours. And then they finally got to see what they'd been paying for. And he said, and so it was that we sat down to watch the early cut of Heaven's Gate. And apparently Cimino said to them, look, it's not quite finished. There's probably 20 minutes to come out of it. And the chapter ends. And so we sat down to watch Heaven's Gate, all 5.5 hours of it.
Wow. Ferdinando Bianchini, who is in Sydney, Australia. If you could meet someone in your family whom you never had the opportunity to meet, who would it be? And then Ferdinando says, for me, it would be my grandfather, a beautiful and kind man whom my dad has told me so much about, but died before I was born, who I'm proud to be named after. Ferdinando, thank you very much. Interesting. I guess everyone's going to go, most people don't really know much about their family beyond a couple of generations.
Yeah.
I would say. Go on.
Well, I mean, I have a very straightforward answer, which is my grandmother, because my grandmother, who is Swiss-German, is not my biological grandmother. She married my grandfather after my grandmother died before I was born. So I never met my grandmother. And the other thing I'd say is, sounds like a weird thing to say, that's on my father's side. So I never met my father's mother, and I wish I had done, because I hear she was a very imposing person and quite the presence. And my grandmother on my mother's side, I only ever knew with Alzheimer's. And I wish that I had known her before that, because again, I've read about her and heard people talk about her, and apparently she was, you know, a incredibly vivacious person. And I only ever really knew when I was a kid, she had very pronounced Alzheimer's, so I never really knew her.
So I guess everyone is going to have versions of this. I mean, my father had a brother, but actually he had two brothers, but his third brother died at the age of one.
Right.
And he died of meningitis. And in fact, I dedicated the last book to Alan Mayo, 1925 to 1926, just because I know that he died of meningitis. But it's just one of those things where you think, so I'm not really playing this game, but I was just thinking, I wonder what he would have been like.
Yeah.
And what, you know, if he'd stayed living as long as his brothers, what that would have been like. So interesting. Yeah. And thank you, Ferdinando, for the question. Alex in Atlanta, what's the weirdest thing someone has casually told you as if it was totally normal? I've struggled with it. The only thing that I've thought of is, and again, I'm not exactly playing Alex. It was one of my earliest visits to an American, coffee being a theme of the week. And I think it was a Starbucks in Lake Tahoe, somewhere like that. And I thought the guy who was serving me the coffee said, do you want a room? because I actually said, I just want a coffee. He said, no, do you want room? And I said, what do you mean? And what he was meaning was, do you want me to leave room
for milk?
Yeah. When did that, why not just say, do you want milk or something like that? But he said, do you want room? I thought, this is ludicrous. Either that or I'm losing my mind completely. So that's the only thing that occurred to me. Someone said casually as if it was totally normal. Maybe it was normal for him. It wasn't normal for me.
Okay. So the weirdest thing someone has ever said casually to me is when I was at Manchester University, I was part of a production called The Death of Joe Hill, which was an original play about Joe Hill, the Wobbly, the union activist. And I was the musical director for it. And the guy who played Joe Hill was a very striking young man called Manuel. And it was a very good play. Ollie Fox was in it, who, of course, Ollie Fox did Klezmer
play, yeah.
And many other people. It was a brilliantly written play, and we toured with it, and we took it to lots of places, and it was a great piece of work. And it ends with Don't Mourn, Organize, which was the Joe Hill slogan. Anyway, so during the course of the production, we spent quite a lot of time together with these people who, you know, with Ollie, obviously, I knew very well, and with John Preston, who was also in it, who was in the Bottlers, and then Manuel, who played Joe Hill. And one day, we were doing a thing about... we were doing a production of it, and then we ended. We must have done 20, 30, you know, maybe 40 performances of it. And I was talking to Manuel, and the subject came up of Stanley Kubrick. And I said something about Stanley Kubrick, and he said, oh, yeah. But, you know, because, of course, you know, well, that's what Stanley's like. And I said, Stanley, you're on first name terms. He said, he's my uncle. And this was Manuel Harlan, who ended up being the stills photographer on Kubrick's later films. And that was a kind of...
Good answer.
Yeah. Wow.
This is Matthew Kershaw, clean driving license. Is there... Oh, yes, lovely interview with Gabriel Byrne on last week's episode. Whenever I hear his name, though, I see Tom Conti.
Oh, that's
so
interesting.
My question is, which two actors do you always confuse?
Nick Cage and Nick Cave.
How about...
Oh, I don't confuse them in the world. I just confuse them.
So Kurt Russell and Jeff Bridges.
Yes, I can. I get that. Yeah. So which two actors when you so it's not that you just mix their names up. It's when you see them, you think it's somebody else.
Anyone? Maybe there isn't anyone.
No, I mean, I'm sure there are. It's often kind of... Oh, I know. Yeah, there was somebody. No, it's not. Okay, so I don't do it anymore. But if you remember, I'm going to... So there is a film in which the confusion between two people is absolutely central. And the film is, do you remember this? Nocturnal Animals, in which Amy Adams and... who's the person who... and Isla Fisher... And Amy Adams and Isla Fisher, there are two parallel stories. One of them is in the real world, mm-hmm. and one of them is the fictional story. And in fact, I believe that you interviewed Amy Adams because quite often up until that point, I had confused Amy Adams and Isla Fisher. I know everyone's going, how on earth could you do that? Because this was at the point before they were both kind of, you know, very, very big. And she said, yes, I know. People have confused us in the past. And actually, it was part of the casting that there was a sort of weird similarity. So I did used to confuse Amy Adams and Isla Fisher. Obviously, haven't done it for many years, but absolutely did used to do that.
Henrietta says, what are some signs that your married friend doesn't have a good marriage?
What are some signs that your married friend doesn't have a good marriage?
Yes.
I have one answer to that, which is this is some time ago.
No names, no pack drill.
No names, no pack drill.
Mm-hmm.
I remember being with a couple and the guy said, yeah, we saw that film and you remember that and we had such a great evening. We loved it. And she said, I've never seen that film.
Mm-hmm. So what you're saying is one of the signs that your married friend doesn't have a good marriage is if they're sleeping with someone else. That's the way you spot that. Yeah. I don't have anything to contribute. Here's an interesting one. I might have more to contribute to this one from Colin. First-time emailer, what are your takes on the new final Beatles song, Now and Then? As you two have an extensive history in the music industry.
And, yeah, we do.
And the song's production involves Peter Jackson, because it was his AI team who were involved in it.
Who were able to take out John Lennon's piano.
I'm curious what you think of the quality of the song and the implications of AI use in restoration and implications for the music industry. Most of the media coverage around this song has noted the involvement of artificial intelligence. And my first thought was, oh no, please don't say they created an AI John Lennon. But after watching the short documentary on Disney Plus, I learned that the artificial intelligence aspect was from Peter Jackson. They used machine learning technology that helped with his Beatles docuseries to isolate and clean up John's voice from old recordings given to Yoko Ono. What band will come back next using AI? I mean, I think, because we made a big thing about it on Greatest Hits, obviously, and I think it's great, actually. It's not Sgt. Pepper, but I don't think anyone was expecting Sgt. Pepper. And I think I was nervous to start with, but then when it started, I thought, oh, no, I mean, John's voice is not amazing, but I thought it's a really, really lovely song and very emotional, actually. And how fantastic to be able to finish with a song called Now and Then, because the other track that it comes with is the first single. So I was impressed, and I like it very much.
Well, the Good Lady Professor, her indoors, and I listened to it in the car on the day of release. And I was very trepidatious because I was working at Radio 1, as were you, when Free as a Bird came out, because that was to coincide with the release of Anthology, wasn't it?
Yeah, I think Anthology 1 and Anthology 2, and they had some extras.
And Free as a Bird is a rubbish song.
Yeah.
It's plodding and uninteresting and crucially unmemorable.
Well, and also because, I mean, Jeff Lynne is a genius and he's done some fantastic work, but he made the Beatles sound like the Traveling Wilburys. And that really, and I like the Traveling Wilburys, but I don't want the Beatles to sound like the Traveling Wilburys.
So sat down to listen to Now and Then with a heavy heart and actually was knocked out. Because I thought the tune was really good. Da, 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 and that da, 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 but weird thing that he does. I thought it was really good. And I at the end of the first thing, it was like, wow. And then I tried to play it again on Spotify and wasn't able to. It was like Spotify would only allow you to play it once. I think so, something weird. But then, since then, listened to it a lot. Total earworm. Really like it. Not crazy about the video.
No, because
the video is shonky.
And well, I wonder what you're going to say there, but what? I did think that.
sorry.
Because they got John goofing around, and I'm not a huge fan of
it. Don't like the video, but I think the song is actually a banger.
And Colin says, what other band will come next using AI? And I just wonder, when I went to see the ABBA Voyage show.
Oh, I haven't seen it. Is it brilliant?
Which is fantastic. And then you come out and you think, who else could they do that to? And I actually think, I'm not sure that it would work, because ABBA is such a good time band, and you're standing up and you're whooping and hollering and you're thinking, this is amazing.
Does it look like they're on stage?
Yes, it does. And then there's a live band off to one side playing live, but it looks like, you know, pitch perfect ABBA looking amazing, like they did, you know, end of the 70s, early 80s, are performing on stage. No, it's done amazingly well.
So the band play live?
Yes, there's a live band and live vocals as well, for, you know, filling in. But it's ABBA with their avatars.
So, but it is the ABBA vocals, right?
It is the ABBA vocals, but I'm not sure that there will be another show like that one particularly.
And it literally looks like they're on stage.
Yeah, I mean, it feels a little bit odd to start with, but yes, it does.
Okay.
So I thought it was a terrific show.
I want to go.
Whether AI will be used in a similar way you have to have a lot of money. There has to be a lot of marketing behind it, but also maybe crucially cult following. So I don't know if they found some rubbish old recordings of Velvet Underground or The Doors or something like that, whether they would go, okay, that might be worth some money.
When my kids were in Hollywood once, we had gone to Hollywood to go and do something, and they had an evening in which they said, oh, we're just going to go down Hollywood Boulevard and go to do something. And one of the things they did was, there's a theater on Hollywood Boulevard that's got a hologram, performances by Elvis and Marilyn Monroe. Okay. Mm-hmm. And they went, okay, great. You know, go and see this because it should be pretty good. And they went in, and firstly, they were the only people in the theater. And secondly, the holograms came on, and it wasn't Elvis and Marilyn Monroe. It was an Elvis impersonator and a Marilyn Monroe impersonator. In which case, why are we watching a hologram? Why don't we just watch the impersonators? Yeah. The whole point of the hologram is because you don't have a hologram of an impersonator. No, absolutely not.
Yeah. So I don't know how this technology will get used in future. It clearly works if you've got a record-breaking band like the Beatles, but I'm not sure there are many other bands that would spend all that time and effort in creating something new.
There are things like the final recordings of Johnny Cash, in which the recordings were just Johnny Cash and an acoustic guitar, and then they were then produced into the final albums. They are quite brilliant, the last ones, but all the stuff was done afterwards, putting the surrounding instruments on afterwards. And I suppose if there are existing tapes of people doing a demo of a song, there is now the possibility to turn that demo into something more professional.
Sure. Okay.
But what you're not doing is generating new songs.
If they found, maybe this is the answer to the question, if they found a really rubbish reel-to-reel recording of an old Gene Vincent song that no one had heard before.
Yeah.
Or, a Buddy Holly or an Elf or something
Yeah.
And it was shonky and shashy and... Maybe then they could go, okay, well, this
we can make this work.
We can make this work.
And of course, there's the thing with like Elvis taking recordings of Elvis's voice and then, like a little less conversation, a little more action, but doing it in the dun, 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 that kind of that upbeat. So that's been done quite a lot. And that's been done with the approval of the Elvis estate. But I suspect that all it is really is if there are old recordings that have been previously unreleased, pretty much everything from most of the great bands now have been released because everything is, what you could do is turn it into a more polished recording by isolating, because this is the thing that the Peter Jackson technology, as far as I understand it,
yes, they tried to work on this in the 90s, but they had no way of separating John's voice with the piano, and now they can do it, it's going to be number one.
Once you can do that, once you can time shift and pitch shift, you can bend the original vocals to fit and arrange. Because quite often, if somebody records a demo, they'll go in and out of time, and they'll go up and down in pitch, but you can now fix that.
Yeah. When I was at Radio 1, I did a 10-part series. It was on the 10th anniversary of John Lennon's death, and it was called In My Life, John Lennon Remembered. And it was produced by Kevin Howlett, who had a fantastic reputation, still does, for making extraordinary documentaries. And in there is a new documentary, two-part documentary about the Beatles' legacy. It's called Beatles' Legacy Red and Blue. And I know this because...
This is the Red and Blue albums, the compilation albums.
Yeah. And I'm hosting them for Great Hits Radio. Oh, but okay. In the original... Kevin Howlett is the host. So there you go. So they've been talking about Beatles for a long time. Final question.
Okay.
From Lois in Aberdeen. What's the first thing you do when you get into a hotel room? Okay. Clean answers only, please.
Well, my ritual is much less OCD than it used to be.
What was it?
Okay, so...
I was just going to say, check the bathroom, because if it's a really horrible bathroom, the whole thing's going to be a bit manky.
Yeah.
That's all I had.
So I wrote several pages about this in a book that I wrote some years ago. I used to be so, I mean, believe me, if you think I'm obsessive compulsive now, you should be, so what I would do is, I had this whole thing that you would get into the hotel, okay? You have to get the towel, and that over the hotel bed, particularly in American hotels, you've got the sheets and the thing, and they get washed, but then you've got the thing on top of it. The bedspread, right? And then often a thing, is it called a valance?
Whatever.
Like a
Ricky Valance, yeah.
Richie Valance, yeah, that's right. So you get the towel that you put over your hands, you remove the valance, and you remove the bedspread, because those don't get washed.
Right.
Okay? And then you put them in a corner of the room with the towel, which you then make wet, and then you put it over the top of it so that they know that it's not to be put back on again. It's the thing. And then you'd start cleaning the bathroom.
And after that?
I mean...
It's time to get up and pay the bill.
But it was this... I used to have this whole absolutely...
What do you do now then?
Well, now I'm a lot... nowadays, people, for a start, if you go into, like the cheaper hotels in the UK, they don't put bedspreads on anymore, because everyone's realised that it's the first thing that any sane person would do is take that thing that hasn't been cleaned and put it somewhere where it can't be reached. Because, they wash the sheets, you hope. They wash the sheets and they wash the thing. And the other thing I do is that, now there's a big thing with duvets with the whole open-ended bottom, because you can get them on and off faster. But make sure that the open-ended bit is down the foot end and that the sheets are actually going over it,
I just, is it like a quick fire question at the end, but actually
for a long time, I used to be completely paranoid about hotel rooms. I mean, like really weirdly paranoid about them.
Because you thought they would be germ?
Bugged, germed.
Not with bugs.
No, with everything. I mean, I went to France when I was at Manchester University. Went on with my friend Andy Hussey. I went to France and I took with me a sleeping bag liner. And he said, why? And I said, well, because I'm going to sleep in the sheets. I'm going to put the sleeping bag liner. And he was like, you know, you're crazy. And I thought, well, you say crazy. I say particular.
I say bug free.
Exactly. Yeah. Yeah, exactly.
So, you've come down with? Check me out with my little special.
And then they used to make jokes about me in a cocoon. They would say, is Mark sleeping in his cocoon? And it was, how very funny. But then I heard a story that apparently Elton John, when he checks into hotel room, there's a whole thing about the sheets have to be new out of the packet and they have to be, you know, like, what?
He's Elton John.
Exactly. You know, yeah. Of course,
square cheese, round roll, all that. You know, yeah. He's done all that.
I wasn't able to go that far, but I was. You know, I was. I would take little things of disinfectant. I'm a lot more relaxed now.
Excellent. I'm clearly going to have to put more work into where you sleep when you come to my house.
No. I love staying at your house because it's one of the reasons I love it is because it's not a hotel. You know, it's a house. I sleep so well upstairs in your house because
slice of chocolate on the pillow and everything.
No, I don't want the slice of chocolate on the pillow. I want the little bit of chocolate downstairs with the cup of tea in which we right the wrongs of the world. And then I sleep like a baby.
If you have a question for next week, the shorter the better. Genuinely, please don't write an essay and then have a question at the end. Just send us some cracking questions and we'll have a go at them. Send them to correspondence@kermanandmayo.com. Thank you for listening. Take one and take two with you on Friday.